This is the Norris Group's Real Estate Investor Radio Show, the award-winning show dedicated to thought leaders shaping the real estate industry and local experts revealing their insider tips to succeed in an ever-changing real estate market. Hosted by author, investor, and hard money lender, Bruce Norris.
Hey everybody, it's Aaron Norris with the Norris Group. We are in our studio today, actually taping in the office here with Bruce Norris, and we're here with Molly and Chris Silva today. So Molly and Chris Silva are realtors and investors based in Riverside, and they followed in the footsteps of their father, Steve Silva, which Bruce Norris worked with extensively over his career. The family has been involved in everything from REOs to real estate investing, and I think there's a story. So how did you meet Steve Silva, Dad?
Your dad had a listing, Bank of America in Moreno Valley. And I just made a blind offer on it. And it was listed at about 65. I made an offer of, I think, 35. And he called me up, and he was not happy. And he said, I'd like to know what you want me to do with this offer. And I said, well, how about submit it and get it accepted? He said, I'd like to do that, pal, but it's so ridiculous. I said, well, the only thing you think, the only reason you think it's ridiculous is you might not be aware of the recent comps. I had just gone to an auction and bought seven of that type for 28 to 35 grand. So I faxed him over the sheets and he just called back. He says, I've never seen anything like this. I want to meet you. And we did get the B of A deal done because they had new evidence that that was a new number and the relationship was born.
Wow.
Have you been? Did you know that story?
No.
I was a part of that.
Oh, you were a part of that.
That was the one?
Was part of my very first transaction.
Was that Gentian or something like that?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Wow. Oh, yeah. That was
a very old part of Moreno Valley.
Yeah.
You had called me and I was down in working in San Marcos.
Okay.
Yeah. And you talked to me like I was a rookie, not even 3 months into the business.
Okay.
And you had called me and told me the exact same story. And I tried to talk to you and you kept talking to me. I'm saying, hey, I think you need to talk to my dad, Steve. Here's his number. The relationship was from there.
Yeah.
And you had bought many, many over there. You told me that when you get into, you'll find yourself, when you're investing in homes, you'll find yourself working in areas in little pockets, and you'll just create more business and more business for yourself within a little area.
Well, you start being the comp that every listing agent gets to look at and say, well, we got an as-is one just like this. So, and then you start getting called by those people saying, you want another one? So it sort of feeds upon itself. So it's kind of cool.
So how did you get involved in the business, Molly?
Oh, my dad asked me, basically, he said, I had just gotten married in 96 and I had graduated college, bachelor's degree from San Bernardino, Cal State. And he says, do you really want to be a teacher? I said, yeah. He says, you realize you can't take just any day off you want and you can work for yourself if you work for me. So that's when he started sending me away to school and learning the tricks of the trade. And I worked for him. I got fired from him for a while, came back, and that's kind of how I got started.
How are you going to drop you got fired and not tell more details? That's pretty awesome.
I can't tell you that story.
Now, What's interesting about what you joined the business after the REOs were really done.
I did.
It improved after
and
that
I,
pretty drastically.
I got in the business when things were sweet for agents, buyer's agents and listing agents. And I was so used to working for myself that when the REOs came in 2000, well, we kind of knew they were coming in 05 to 06, I had to get used to working for banks, which was really a hard pill to swallow because I was used to working for myself.
Yeah.
Now I'm working for the corporate banks, which was really difficult because it had transitioned from this human contact, you know, over the phone back in the 90s to this, you know, computer screen in front of you, basically.
Fun.
Even your dad had to, you know, make a change, and it wasn't nearly as much. It wasn't as efficient. It was certainly, the lenders were trying. I remember looking at those prices, you know, Moreno Valley was 350. And so they tried to get 280 in a house they'd ultimately get 80 for. Mm-hmm. So they were so far away. Remember they had a grading system for you to, like, if you didn't sell it, you got a bad grade and the listing got taken to you from you and given to someone else who had just gotten a bad grade and was going to give you their house, like somebody's going to pull some magic off.
They would just say good luck.
Yeah. So the lenders took a while because they didn't listen to people that knew. You know, if they had listened to your dad who knew, it's like, you ain't going to get anything close to that. You might as well get what you can now, if that's your intent.
Yeah.
Well, all right. So the goal is we are covering in the California Only Investor Series, we have a course called Buying Systems. So we're going through each strategy and beating it up a little bit and adding a whole segment on the very back end, talking about how specific strategies change depending on the timing of stuff. So the quadrant system. So we'll go through that. Chris, the only thing I missed is how you got in the business.
I was going to school in Orange County, and I had one class left, and my dad had just got into the real estate business. We was in it probably 2 years, and I kind of didn't like it, what I was going to school for.
What were you going to school for?
Commercial refrigeration.
Oh.
Design and, you know, all that stuff. And it was a lot. It was a long, lot of schooling I went to, and I had one class left. And I'm like, you know what? I don't want to do this. So got into real estate.
Wow.
Started hanging repo signs. I did all those bootleg signs that you see all over the place that you hate.
I hate them.
But I was putting up bank repo signs for houses, you know, getting, you know, $75 a house and mowing yards and working real estate part-time. And, you know, then here I am today.
Wow.
And your dad actually came from the car auction business,
correct,
right?
Car okay, business.
I remember that.
Yeah, he had car business. Okay. Yeah. Wholesaler.
All right. Now it's a family biz. Where's he at today?
Retired.
He's semi-retired.
All right.
He needs to be in it a little bit more, but he's, you know, he's enjoying
it. Having way too much
fun. He's enjoying it.
All right.
He's earned the right.
He got a new puppy, which is the whole, he's part of always being home right now. So,
okay. Well, the strategy that we're going to cover today is the first one anyway. We're going to cover two back to back. The first is agents who control inventory. And we've sort of already alluded to some of your experiences. So we're going to bust this down by quadrant. So quadrant one is the market turn from around 2006 to 2007. We call that quadrant one. So did you, especially Molly, you, this was completely new. You had never seen a downturn.
Never.
So were you guys talking about in 2006, 2007, saw the writing on the wall, and what did you do?
My dad had us set up perfectly.
Really?
He saw the writing on the wall. I bought my home in December 20, 2005. He told me, don't do it. And I said, Dad, I'm going to sell my house, make money, I'm going to put it into this house. And he said, don't do it. And I did it. And he was right. He set us up to where he had the relationships had already built from the previous down market that he had such a great grade and
think about that. Think about how long that stayed in place.
Exactly.
8-9 years and they're still calling the same people.
The same people.
Okay. But the agents do the same thing with the investors. So if you were kind of a good contact at that point, you got called by all those people and said, this was the question, are you still in? Because they want the same thing. They want a reliable source to say, okay, this one out of 40 that's going to go like that and go for cheap, they want a phone to pick up and know it's going to close and it's not going to be, I didn't see it yet, and all that garbage.
And you know, it's funny because during that time, I'm getting a little ahead, but what you hit the nail on the head. I had just maybe a couple investors that would call me. And one of them, I could still remember their name. I would call them right now. It was a father-son team because it was so easy. It was like they did all the research. They knew exactly. I didn't have to do anything. I didn't have to leave my desk and sell a house. They just made it easy.
Mm-hmm. Right. You know? Okay. So all those players were still in place. So he just picked up the phone and maybe it was the back end before.
Not all of them.
Okay. So there were some new players.
And times it was different.
Okay.
Back in the 90s when you did the REOs, it was take a picture, you know, take pictures, go to the photo mat, glue them, mail everything in to the bank, you know, no monthly reports. We didn't have to do any of that. It was all basically phone relationship. This time around, you know, you had to apply online with the banks. They didn't really know. You couldn't reach out and touch someone and pick a phone up.
Right.
You know, so it was, yes, it was still some people in the business,
mm-hmm.
but, you know, we did have that history. We did have a good resume. to fall back onto to show. Mm-hmm. But, you know, things have changed. I mean, it's, and whenever we have another REO situation, things are going to be different than they were last time.
Did the technology piece seem to catch them off guard, or in 05 and 06 were those things being put in place?
It caught me off guard a little bit, only because we had to use the computer so much and the systems, their systems. That was totally different.
Since we're going to talk about the quadrants, so quadrant one is before it hits the fan, basically.
Right.
That's that calm before the storm. Right. But that's when you cement relationships and say, we're going to have this long ride. I want to be in the top couple of people when you call. So it's harder after that because they've already got that established.
Well, that's what's so interesting hearing, you know, he saw the writing on the wall and, you know, we're skipping down, but, you know, what are the opportunities for investors? You'd really have to know that this was coming and to call the Silvas and be like, hey, this is coming. What are we doing? Are you getting set up?
My dad saw the writing on the wall because of Bruce. He listens to Bruce.
Yeah.
And that's the truth.
Well, it's a big help to an agent even to be the first one that calls a lender because it's all fine. And all of a sudden your dad calls and it's not going to be fine very long. And I'm still in, you know, that it's good to have your place in line in all those lines because all of a sudden they realize when it starts to happen, God, this guy was right. Who cares what the source is? In other words, it's just nice that they have somebody to go to on the front line. And I remember your dad. In the beginning, he was taking listings in Timbuktu. I mean, he would go out to
Oildale,
you know, whatever, to get
Bakersfield, Oildale.
Listing just because you set the precedent. So if somebody like him asked me to bid on a property in Bakersfield, hey, I'd get up 4 in the morning and drive there. You just would. That's how it's played.
Well, you have to.
Yeah, you want to get the number two one, you do that.
And when I first started, that's what I had a list of agents, and I'd call them once a week, once a month. Hey, okay, nothing this week, I'll call you next week, you know. That sooner or later they'll be nice to you on the phone. You know, a lot of times they weren't, but that's what I would do. That was part of my regime because there wasn't anything. I learned this all by myself. I never went to any of your seminars. You know, I just kind of learned everything myself. Your boot camps then. You used to do the boot camps. Yeah. And I just kind of learned the whole process because there wasn't – nothing was – it was just the infancy of the computers. It was very difficult for me to learn it, but I learned it, you know, trial and error. But the one thing is I called, you know, instead of looking at 50 houses a day, I can call 50 agents and now I have access to a lot more inventory. And the more I call, they're going to call me back.
Well, what's cool about that too, is you'll get the one that's got, it's sort of like a mailer in a way. If you ever did a mailer, you'll get a call and it seems like, oh, gosh, this is so cool. Well, whatever hit the fan just about 5 minutes before you open your mailer. And that can happen with a phone call. So the agent has one they know was going to close and it falls out and you call. Okay, but it's yours. You've earned the right. You've called 4 times. Now, he might have a number one or number two guy. They're not going to get that one because you hustled. Mm-hmm. That's how you break into this stuff.
So in 2006 and 2007, you had investors calling you saying we're ready to go when you are?
I don't think it was that. It was so new. It was so new, and things kept going down and down. And I remember waking up on seeing at the front of the Press Enterprise and the LA Times, seeing a picture of a street in Moreno Valley with nothing but for sale signs, and 5 of them were ours.
Yeah, that was definitely in quadrant two, and that would have been 08 or something.
Yeah,
it was already obvious.
Yeah.
But having investors, it didn't hit till a little bit later for us.
The thing I wanted to capture is if you're a real estate investor, this specific strategy isn't really powerful necessarily in quadrant one, but laying the groundwork and the relationships are definitely. And what's interesting is that now I look back over the last downturn, was my first downturn, is it seemed like a lot of the same players. How many REO agents really existed in Riverside, like the mecca of foreclosures?
Not very many.
Right. And it was a lot of the same players from the time before. So,
correct. And a lot of them are still the only ones you see with any REO listings.
Agreed. So, okay. So quadrant two, we're going to go to the bust market. So 2007 to 2011. We had talked a little bit about this, but it caught a little bit of everybody off guard a little bit, how quickly and how deep it went. So how many listings did you go from like in 2007, just in a year? Did it just explode?
Yes.
It exploded, yeah. I mean, we were all of a sudden hiring people, having people come work for us. You know, we had agents working for us. But it was a lot of work. It was a whole lot of work. But we were able to, you know, with our name, and we still bought and sold. We couldn't buy our inventory. Mm-hmm. But we had relationships still with the other REO agents, so we were able to purchase property. Okay. But we just couldn't do our own.
Yeah, conflict of interest.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, as much as we wanted to.
I actually brought my primary residence from you two.
Yes.
I was not the highest and best. I was up against an all-cash offer. We barely saved it. Do you remember Fannie Mae was giving me a difficult time because we found out that the city had levied? I didn't know that they could do this. They actually came into our HOA and levied liens because of dead grass. Because the cities were loving doing that to REO listings.
They don't like that anymore in your neighborhood.
And I had to call in some major favors with the city, but we got it done.
They and closed. Doing that.
Yeah, so... So how many listings do you think you were doing at the peak?
We had about 200 at any given day.
Wow.
Yeah.
It was a lot of work.
See, what was frustrating, I'll just speak up for the realtors, because they were not informed that this was maybe not going to continue. And I found that very frustrating. Remember, the default numbers kept on rising, but your REOs went down.
They did.
They just stopped foreclosing. And I was actually on a panel. This was a, remember that? I got carted off by the security. But the reason it happened is I stood up for you guys. I was just one of the guys being asked questions, and I didn't think it was the right questions. And so I started taking over the interview process, and I started being very direct with lenders, saying, why aren't you telling these guys they're not going to get the listings? And I mean, basically at the end of it, the security guy came up. He says, I've been instructed to take you to your room.
Oops.
Was that the shadow inventory that everybody was talking about, except they were just selling it off to these big...
They just weren't foreclosing. Yeah, there was no point in foreclosing because they were going to get 80 cents on the dollar hit. And so they just, remember.
They kept using us to get values, and we did so much free work.
That's right, for nothing.
So much free work. It was unbelievable.
But your numbers went down after it should have continued. You should have had 500 within 18 months. You probably had 100, and you were setting up for volume. So you were incurring expenses and all that. You know, that's the stuff that was pretty frustrating. So I didn't like that.
And being an REO agent is expensive.
It is, of course,
because we have to pay for rehabs. Yeah, it's changed now a little bit, and some banks are different than others. But we've had to pay for rehabs, utilities, wait to get reimbursed, hire an accountant to do all that, and then hopefully you get reimbursed.
The other thing, I want to mention too, that when you guys, when you have an REO account, there's a long line of people behind you that want the REO account because it's literally the only thing that's producing income. So as an investor, when I make an offer and we're in quadrant two and it's real bad, I've got to make sure that thing closes because you know what? Their reputation's on the line. I make an offer and the lender goes, I finally said yes, took a beating, and then it falls out of escrow. Man, they don't look good. And there's somebody right behind them that says, well, it'll never happen to me, and they'll get their shot.
Exactly.
And the one thing my dad taught us and that he learned from you is once you make an offer, you stick with that offer. You know, and there's a lot, we still today get offers from people because we'll do some wholesaling. And, or we hear from other agents, and these wholesalers will, they're trying to purchase property, and then last minute, we need a $10,000 reduction. Yeah.
I finally saw the inside.
Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly.
And it's so mind-boggling why they do that. It's reputation. We're in it for a long time. I don't know what their thoughts are. But, we plan on sticking in Riverside and,
You just pointed out something real important because you just mentioned something that probably that conversation or that reputation was built 10 years ago, but it's stuck. In other words, when this guy puts it in escrow, it's going to close.
Yep.
That's how you end up with leads. You just do.
It has to.
If they screw up like that, do you have the opportunity not to submit that offer if they're still playing games? So
then you can skew. Yes. Because if you come to our office when we're doing the REOs, you present an offer. She kind of talked a little bit about it. You bring your offer in, and everybody else is emailing their offers, but you hand present someone your offer, she's going to remember you.
Oh.
I always do that, yeah. And what I would always do, too, is there's always comments that I can – there's always comments because you have to submit all your offers online back in the day.
Mm-hmm.
And so I always put the comments, this agent will close, blah, blah, blah. Please consider this over this other – buyer. Or this buyer has, purchased assets before, but always last minute wants to reduce the price, but you just want to close it. Sometimes the asset manager will say, I just want to get it closed. We'll take the price reduction.
Oh, okay. So they are looking at those notes.
Oh, they looked absolutely at those notes.
Okay. So if somebody burns you.
Oh, yeah. I remember.
Absolutely.
We share absolutely the blacklist.
Still today. Oh, and
the best part of the blacklist now in social media is it goes all over social media.
Oh, no.
Oh, blacklist is, yeah.
I think Susan Ray actually had a book.
And there's a lot of lenders in the book.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So. You know what, though? It's just... We are professionals.
Yeah.
You know, and there's so many people doing what we do, and how do you stand out? You know, it's hard work.
Yeah.
You know, I don't go out and put the bandit signs up. You know, do they work? I don't know. But I do marketing, lots of mailing. You know, we spend a lot of money every month, you know, to get to where we are and to continue keeping our inventory at where they're at.
Right. So some of the, there's obviously new players, whether they're realtors or investors that enter the market. What were some of the things that, how investors stood out during the cycle for the downturn?
Because I worked with a few investors, and the investors that I worked with, I only worked with a few. Sorry. Okay. I only worked with a few, and I've had them come to my office and sit down with me on New Year's Day. Oh, we have this whole plan that we're going to do this, this, and this. Fine and great, but... And then they would finally say, would you relist my properties? Well, yeah, I'm going to let you talk to one of my buyers or one of my agents, because I'm not going to do it. I'm not interested in double ending anything anymore. Conflict of interest. And if something goes wrong, mostly on an REO, I don't want that sitting over my head. So I'll let one of the agents in my office deal with that.
Okay.
But when they turn around and say, yeah, but I want you to take 0.75 points to relist, that's when you say...
Yeah.
Thank you, but no thank you at that point. And that happened a lot. Now investors are, you know, a little bit more savvy, and they know what to do to get a property. And we do it too. You know, we those same tactics go for us as investors, but the investors that stuck out in my mind are the ones that would just do all their due diligence and go down to the city and deal with things and say, "Hey, I'm ready to close."
Yep. Okay.
You know, and they'd send me a Christmas card and, you know, come in the office and, you know, we've met each other a few times, but that's basically it. They make things easy.
You mentioned the face-to-face, so.
Yeah, that's so the good. Important. The bad ones are, they just send you blind offers.
Okay.
You never hear from them. Those are the bad ones.
Okay. So. And especially when you're dealing with that kind of volume. Did you get a lot of the people doing the guru web, you know, seminars that were coming in? And
oh, yeah. I won't say any names on that particular
My one favorite name. One was still a realtor who called in. It was a hard money loan that we were getting. And the agent flat out said, yeah, they're not going to make many money on this one. This one will be practice.
Practice. I asked the agent, I said, are you getting paid in this practice?
Yeah, exactly.
And the whole there was another little caveat. And we, because remember, I used to come and speak at your boot camp quite a bit. A whole nother caveat was, and it's not as much of an issue anymore, is this really cash or is this hard money?
That's right.
Because it was very different when back in, you know, that quadrant there. It was, hard money was very different than cash. Now, hard money is almost just as easy as cash. So.
Has that changed? So, yeah, or how do you know it's legit? Because we're very careful who we write the letters of credit to. We don't just give it to anybody. So when you get a letter of credit from a hard money lender, how do you want them to write it? Do you want them to lie and say it's all cash? Because I've heard it both ways.
I honestly, do they have proof of funds? And if they legitimately have proof of funds and they throw in a hard money lender, that's okay now because it's just as easy. I mean, there's no downtime, mostly with, you know.
Well, it's also not the same seller. See, if it was a corporate seller, then different. You could have an issue because the loan or the transaction docs will say, don't do that or we're going to have a problem.
And escrow would throw a little fit because they have to throw a deed of trust.
So now you're dealing with a private seller. It's just if you can convey, it's going to close. Yeah, I know these guys. Then it's the same thing.
And as investors, we do that. We just throw out, you know, our proof of funds. Here's a proof of funds. We go into escrow. We...
Slide in the hard money.
Slide it in, and
sometimes
it just,
it's hard money. Sometimes it's, you know, it's our cash, we've never in the last 5 years we haven't had an issue with it.
Okay, Unfortunately, that's all the time we have this week to cover this specific buying strategy. For those who are subscribers, the entire interview is going to be in the portal under the buying systems chapter, so you can check it out there. Next week, we will be covering expired listings.
For more information on hard money loans and upcoming events with the Norris Group, check out thenorrisgroup.com. For information on passive investing with trust deeds, visit tngtrustdeeds.com.